fellowship and continue on here dealing with the concept of category two love, which is right man, right woman, but extends into issues related to the family. We're down to sub-point D here. Consistent verbal instruction coupled with physical discipline as needed is the standard espoused by the Word of God. Deuteronomy 6, 6 and 7. Child has to be taught what to do, what's expected, what the rules are, and all that. They don't get it by osmosis. They don't simply just know it. They're not born knowing it, that's for sure. The primary responsibility for this lies with the parents. As we provide here a prep school in order to supplement parental teaching of doctrine, but it is not to be the primary norm. The norm has to come from the household itself. And these words which I am commanding you today shall be on your heart, and you shall teach them diligently to your sons, and you shall talk of them when you sit in your house, and when you walk by the way, and when you lie down, and when you get up. And the reality is, of course, that this is the lifestyle of the positive believer. Proverbs 29:15 is the next one. That the positive believer recognizes the value of parental instruction with respect to doctrine. And most households don't get it. I remember, you know, when I was a kid, my parents did some things right from a biblical perspective. In many cases, they didn't do a lot of things right. I wasn't instructed on the importance of the local church. I wasn't instructed. I mean, they sent me to church, but at a certain point, well, you know, there's no example there. You can get up and send your kids to church all you want, but if there's no example there that this is important to you, well, guess what? The kid picks up on it pretty fast. Kids are not that stupid. Proverbs 29:15, the rod and reproof give wisdom. Reproof is basically just being told you're wrong. The rod is a figure for corporal discipline, for overt punishment. This is how you get wisdom through to the heart of a child, but a child who gets his own way brings shame to his mother. And realistically, if a child hasn't been consistently disciplined by the time they're 8, 9, 10 years old, you've probably lost them. They're probably going to grow up to be idiots. There's exceptions to that, and obviously we factor in God's grace, and a kid can turn themselves around, but the parents bear the bulk of that responsibility for that. They have to be instructed. That you can't just discipline them. They have to be explained to as to why these things are the way they are, why we don't steal, why we don't beat up the kids in the neighborhood, why we don't do this or that, why we attend Bible class four times a week when other people, you know, if they go once or twice, it's no big deal to them. Why we live the lifestyle we live, why we don't pursue the details, why we do this and that, and all the other factors of the Christian life. The necessity for, you know, consistent prayer and these sorts of things. Don't just lunge. Pray about things. Reflect on things. Take some time. Don't be your typical Babylonian. And also Ephesians 6:4 in the New Testament deals with this concept. Addressing the father specifically because they tend to be the most demanding. And again, not that there's, quote, anything wrong with that. It's taken sort of as a statement of convention. We expect this sort of out of the fathers. But fathers, do not provoke your children to anger by putting unrealistic, and now mothers do this too. They put unrealistic expectations. One of the things I've seen, and I don't know if it's a function of the last days or if people have always done this, but you see parents living their lives vicariously through their children. I observe this. I see it more in women than I do in men, but that's not to say men never do it. I think in my generation, it was, you know, the dads lived through their children playing baseball. You know, they may have wanted to be a major league baseball player, and, you know, so they want the same for their son or whatever it was. Sports is a way, one of the ways they do it. But you see this, you know, parents enforcing their norms and standards on a child, not because it's best for the child, but simply because that's what they want to do. That's the way they would want it done for them, as it were. And so they live vicariously through their children. They're way overly involved in their children. They know every detail about everything. They're in on all the juicy gossip. Why? That's a sign of a parent that's living their life through their children. And that's not appropriate. I've seen people do this. And so they begin, and one of the things that happens I've seen is then they begin to make doctrinal exceptions. Oh, well, yeah, you can do this, even though, you know, doctrine says otherwise. No, you shouldn't miss Bible class for that. That's a non-essential. And so these exceptions are made. Why? Because they're right, or the right thing to do. No, parents are living their lives through their children in some cases. And that's inappropriate. So you don't lay these unrealistic expectations on them. You got to recognize what your children are. You know, in my house, basically, I made straight A's all the time. It was no big deal. My brothers weren't as smart. And that, you know, for my parents to force them to make straight A's all the time. Oh, if you make a B, that's a bad thing. A B isn't a bad thing. What idiot told you that? You know, these unrealistic expectations. You've got to be an honor student at all times. And you've got, you know, and then force these children into things that maybe wasn't ever God's will for them in the first place. Who knows? Who's to say? Again, you put these unrealistic expectations on them, things they can't do. They have to be explained how to do something. You know, if you tell the child who's 8 years old or whatever to go wash the car and they scrub it with a Brillo pad, that's your fault. You didn't tell them you don't use a Brillo pad on the car. I remember one time Michael was helping me. He washed out the gas tank with water. In the lawnmower, not in the car. You don't put water in the gas tank. The mower wasn't the same after that, to say the least. But he thought he was helping. You know, well, hey, that's my bad. That's on me. I didn't never, you know, of course you would think you wouldn't have to tell him that, but, you know, you have to bear some of the responsibility as a parent in this. So, but if you haven't instructed him, you haven't told him how to do something, how can you expect him to do it? You can't. That's unrealistic. And it frustrates the child. How can you please a parent who, when you don't even know what they want? And in some cases, their demands are so earth-shattering that no child could meet up to it. And guess what? You got to nurture them. You got to bring them up in the discipline first. It's ironic to me that discipline always leads us off in the discipline and instruction of the Lord. And so doctrine has to not just be talked about. It has to be lived out in front of them. The parents must deal with the problem of the child's sin nature consistently and cannot allow themselves to be deterred by the child's tears. Again, I remember when the kids were younger, they could be crying just when I'd take the belt off. You know, I remember, you know, my dad had, you know, when I was getting spanked, when are you going to do better? Now! Now I'm going to do better. 23:13. Do not hold back discipline from the child. Though you beat him with the rod, he will not die. He just will sound like he's dying. He will try to convince you he's dying. But, you know, a good spanking never killed a child that I know of. I've never heard of that. But again, this gets into, you know, the proper way to spank and all of that. You know, apparently people in our society are idiots. You don't use bicycle chains to discipline your child. I mean, good Lord. The Bible's really, really plain on this. And guess what? The little STA is going to be there. It's going to be an ongoing factor. You're going to have to deal with it. And so you just have to learn how to be the bad guy. That's what some people get tired of. I get tired of being the bad guy. Well, guess what? So do I. But that doesn't get you off the hook just because you're tired of being the bad guy. You have to be the bad guy. That's the way it is. Children will push you into this with their disobedience. And if you don't deal with it, then you're responsible. You become guilty before God. So F, the parents are the first line of instruction and defense against the sin nature. Failure to fulfill that responsibility brings shame on the parents and discipline on the child. Proverbs 22:15. Foolishness is bound up in the heart of a child. I like the parents that look at me like, you know, my children are different. You're an idiot. You are an idiot. Your children are no different than anybody else's children. All parents think that. Guess what? No, they're not. Guess what? They've got stupidity bound up in their heart. And they'll show it to you from time to time. You'll get to see how stupid they really are. And the reality is kids will do the dumbest things. I remember, you know, when we, you know, I was young, you know, I thought playing with matches on windy days was cool. It wasn't, as it turns out. Do some really stupid stuff. Our kids thought playing with matches under an 80-year-old wood frame house was cool. A dryer and a bone. They found out it wasn't. Fortunately, they just learned through spanking and not the hard way. They didn't burn the thing down on top of themselves. Me, I learned the hard way. Burned up the field and then got the spanking of a lifetime. Guess what? Kids do stupid stuff. I remember thinking, you know, you could get a sheet and get up on some high object and jump off and hold all four corners and it'd be like a parachute. It's not. It's not like a parachute. But kids can't think very well beyond the end of their nose, hardly. And they get themselves into some big jams, and it's because they don't think. It's because they're stupid. Let's face it, kids are born stupid, naturally born stupid. And you have to teach them to kind of outgrow that. And some things they're going to learn the hard way. You know, I learned as a kid, losing your temper and hitting something really, really hard, it's not the wisest thing. You can hurt your hand. You know, so you learn these things, you learn them the hard way. And guess what? I remember now when I was a kid, I was like 6 years old. I remember this girl, I don't know, she was 12 or 13 or something. She got in her dad's car, decided she was going to drive it. Drove it right into this other trailer and almost killed somebody. But 12 and 13-year-olds aren't smart enough, apparently, to figure that out. And so you see, kids really do dumb stuff. The Bible's not exaggerating here by any level. Stupidity is bound up in the heart of a child, but the rod of discipline will remove it far from him. I can teach you how to knock that foolishness out of them, and that's discipline. Proverbs 29, also 15 and 17. This one we've seen, the rod and the reproof give wisdom, but a child who gets his own way brings shame to his mother. Correct your son, verse 17, and he will give you comfort. He will also delight your soul. And the reality is the opposite of this is true, too. Don't correct him, and you're going to have misery. And you're going to deserve the misery. Gee, parents that will not effectively follow through in this area demonstrate they do not actually love their child. All their protests to the contrary. The fact is, the Bible determines that what love is. And people say, well, I love my children. I would never spank them. Well, you're an idiot. The Bible makes it plain that you're an idiot. You'd be better off saying, hey, I'm an idiot. That'd be closer to the truth. Proverbs 13:24. He who spares his rod hates his son. Well, we've seen that one, and also 19:18. Discipline your son while there is hope, and do not desire his death. And the hope is while there's hope is when he's young. Once he gets older, it's going to be too difficult. It's not going to happen. And we've seen this lived out in lives. You know, you got basically 25, 30, 40-year-old people who are still essentially children in their thinking because they never were disciplined. They never had somebody rein them in and grab their little STA up and give them by the scruff of the neck and let them know, here's the way it is. And I loved it because, again, you'll run into, one of the things I run into, inevitably, as you will in life, you'll see these people that haven't exercised their authority properly as parents, and so their children are undisciplined. Well, guess what? I don't have to put up with that. You may put up with that little brat, but I don't have to. And I won't. I'm not going to put up with it. Or you see husbands, you know, one of the things in life, I've had to butt heads with a number of women. But inevitably, it was horsey women whose husbands didn't rein them in. And guess what? You may let your wife be horsey and do what she wants, but I don't have to. I don't have to put up with it. I don't see any mandate to me to tell me that, oh, well, you got to put up with this stupidity. Oh, no, I don't. So the reality is you can go your own way, but guess what? You may pay the price. H, normal physical discipline does not include physical abuse, nor does it include oppressing the child with unrealistic expectations or demands, Colossians 3:21. You know, we got a whole society of children now that are on Prozac and Ritalin because why? Is some of the problem because the parents have been pushing and pushing and pushing and pushing and pushing and never learned how to back off and let their kid have some fun? Why in the world is everybody in such a big hurry to grow up? I'll tell you what, I would love to go back to being 8, 9, 10 years old again where I played baseball all summer. That was pretty carefree days. And it wasn't the summer of 69, but it was the best days of my life at that point. I mean, just from a carefree sort of attitude and all of that. And you know what? They used to let kids be kids. Not anymore. Boy, you've got to have your life planned out by the time you're 12 now. Why? Who said? When did this rule come into effect? But see, the world I was born and raised in isn't the same world we live in today. The world I was born and raised in taught me that the 200-pound man does not have the right-of-way over the 2,000-pound vehicle. That you don't just step out in front of cars. Well, my parents taught me that. They say, you'll end up dead. Now I watch people, they think, I'm a pedestrian, I've got the right-of-way. No, you don't. That's ridiculous. The reality is, I would yield to the car if I were you. That's when I was driving up Beneva the other day. There's some guy in the bike lane, and he sees there's some construction up there, so he basically waves at me and tells me to slow down, to get out of his way. I said out loud, if I was you, I'd move over. I'm driving the car. I think the 60-pound bicycle's going to lose if there is an altercation. I'm not going to intentionally run over anybody or hit them, but good Lord, where do people get these ideas? The insanity of people. Try to teach your children, hey, don't run out into the street. You can get killed. Well, they'll only get killed once, I guess. Proverbs 3:21, fathers, do not exasperate your children, that they may not lose heart. And that's the thing. You can drive them so far down into the ground, and guess what? They never can think they're going to make it or be anything. And that's just from unrealistic expectations and constantly putting it on the kid. I've seen parents like this. And their children grow up with all this baggage of, man, I never was good enough. I never quite measured up. And so they spend the rest of their lives trying to get their parents' approval. They should have had it in the first place. See here, category three love, which is love for personal friends. Now, one, this aspect of love is best demonstrated by the relationship of David and Jonathan. 1 Samuel 18:1-4. We have examples of this in the Bible, but this, in my opinion, was one of the best ones. These guys were really, really good friends. How many really good friends do you have? Well, the point is, you only have as many really good friends as you want. But friendship is complicated, it's complex, and it's demanding. People say, well, how come I don't have more friends? Maybe you're not very friendly. Maybe that's your problem. You can't isolate yourself from everybody all the time and assume, well, I'm going to have a lot of friends. You know, it doesn't work that way. 1 Samuel 18, and it came about that when he had finished speaking to Saul, that the soul of Jonathan was knit to the soul of David. And Jonathan loved him as himself. And Saul took him that day and did not let him return to his father's house. And Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as himself. And Jonathan stripped himself of the robe that was on him and gave it to David. Jonathan was in the royal family, so this is obviously a great honor that he's bestowing on David. He gave it to David with his armor, including his sword and his bow and his belt. And so what did this do? David and Jonathan had this really great friendship. Also, 2 Samuel 1:26 deals with this. And a really, really good friend. Well, what's it worth? And this is David's eulogy when he's talking about Jonathan after his death. Jonathan in 1:26, I am distressed for you, my brother Jonathan. You have been very pleasant to me. Your love to me was more wonderful than the love of women. How have the mighty fallen and the weapons of war have perished? And as you get older, as you live through life, and as David had lived through life and was getting older, you recognize, see, when you're 18, the only thing you think about is sex. When you're 28, you start to slow down. When you're 38, you slow down even more. By the time you're 48, you realize that sex isn't the most important thing in the world. And David articulates that here, that having really, really good friends is even better than good sex sometimes. I know for some of you that are young, that's probably shocking. But it's true. It's true, because you're going to get old and you're going to realize that the value of having really good friends that stick with you through thick and thin through all the years. And you know what? I think some people are jealous because they don't have good friends like that. They don't have good doctrinal friends that they've stuck with for 15, 20, 25, 35 years. I do. And if you're jealous of that, well, I'm sorry, but I'm not going to give up my friends for you. I've got relationships based on doctrine that have go back way before I got here. And guess what? Being friends, you're going to realize the value of having good Category 3 friends someday. Two, a true friend loves consistently at all time, maintaining loyalty and allegiance to his friend. Proverbs 17:17. People come at me and they say, well, so-and-so does thus and such wrong. How can you be their friend? I say, well, how can I not? What do you want me to do? I'm going to cancel my friendship because you made a mistake. Well, that's a good friend. That's who you need, really, in your crisis moments, isn't it? You make a mistake and they write you off? Well, that's not the kind of friends I want. The reality is Proverbs 17:17. A friend loves at all times, and a brother is born for adversity. If you're going to have good friends over the years, you're going to go through difficult times with them. They're going to have hard times. You're going to have hard times. You're going to suffer with them. And if you're not willing to suffer with them, you aren't a very good friend. When the heat's on and the screws are tightened down, we'll find out how good of friends you really are. You'll show yourself for what you are. And guess what? Most people aren't. Most people are not good friends. They're friends when things are pleasant. They're friends when things are easy. But you put the adversity test on them, and bam, they're gone. They will flee like they were running from a lion. And that isn't a good friend. Proverbs 18:24. A man of many friends comes to ruin. Some people are out there pursuing friendship. That's not appropriate either. You have to wait for God to bless you with this. And there is a friend who sticks closer than a brother. Three, a real friend can be counted on to respond in adverse situations or unexpected times of testing. Luke 11:5-8. Here, this isn't a parable, but it demonstrates the point, even though it's just a parable. Suppose one of you shall have a friend, and you shall go to him at midnight. Well, if you've got a good friend, you can call him whenever you need to, near as I know. And the reality is, if you've got a good friend, you expect him to respond, even at a difficult time, at a difficult hour, at a late hour. Suppose one of you have a friend, and you go to him at midnight and say, friend, lend me 3 loaves, for a friend of mine has come to me from a journey. He showed up late. I wasn't prepared. I'm in a bind here. Can you help me out? And I have nothing to set before him. And from inside, he will answer and say, do not bother me. The door is already shut. My children and I are in bed, and I can't get up to give you anything. I tell you, even though he will not get up and give him anything because he is his friend, yet because of his persistence, he will get up and give him as much as he needs. And so this is a parable. The meaning, the root interpretation of the parable is about persistence in prayer. You don't give up. But in the ideal situation, you wouldn't have to. You go to knock on the guy's door at midnight. He gets up and he gives you what you need. That's friendship. That's a part of friendship, anyway. For a true friend does not slander or malign. He can be counted on to tell you what you need to hear, even when it is painful. This is where most people fail because they don't establish real friendships. Psalm 15:3. They don't have good friends because they're really not open and honest with each other. And that's a part of friendship. But certain things you know, as well as I do, certain people aren't going to hear certain things. They just don't want to hear them. And you can either stifle yourself, or you can go ahead and be honest and tell them the truth. And that risks the friendship, essentially. But to have friends, you've got to be willing to risk the friendship sometimes and say things that are hard to hear. Psalm 15:3, he who does not slander with his tongue, nor does evil to his neighbor, nor takes up a reproach against a friend. This is, in effect, this psalm, Psalm 15, is sort of about what's a mature believer like. Who's going to really reside with God, as it were? Who's going to be God's friend in that regard? And certain things that God's friends don't do. Also, Proverbs 27:6-9. I've got friend, and I tell you what, I've talked to some of my friends like Dutch uncles. I'd have some of you in tears if I talked to you the way I've talked to some of my friends. You couldn't take it. You can't handle the truth. But the reality is you have to have that kind of relationship. If you don't, you really don't have much of a friendship at all. Proverbs 27, here, verse 6. Faithful And the word wounds is actually bruise, the bruises of a friend. But deceitful are the kisses of an enemy. So your friend may tell you hard things to hear. You may not appreciate them. And let's assume, for the sake of the argument, that they're right. Well, those are the bruises. When they come up and buffet you around, as it were, and tell you things that you don't want to hear. But most people, they aren't really good friends. They just put on a facade and pretend to be friendly when in fact they're not. They cover it all up. That's not friendship. That's hypocrisy, in fact. That's giving your lines off from under a mask. It's pretending to be something you're not. Also, verse 9, oil and perfume make the heart glad. So a man's advice is sweet to his friend. And I've got some friends. Matter of fact, I've got one friend. I'll tell him something difficult. He said, well, faithful are the bruises of a friend. And the relationship is reciprocal. I fully expect my friends to be just as honest with me as I am with them. But a lot of people don't have any open, honest relationships. They really don't. And so they miss out on this really great blessing. But having friends is difficult. I will tell you that out of the chute. But I wouldn't want to live in a world without friends. That, to me, is pathetic. I would just as soon be dead as not have friends. That's the way I am. 5, a real friend is not influenced by your wealth or lack thereof. However, this is not the norm for many superficial people. Proverbs 19, 4, 6, and 7. Some people are just flat superficial. If you've got money, if you've got all the wherewithal to do things for them, well, sure they want to be your friend. Would you like me to take you out to a fine steak? Sure! Well, I can't afford 2 pennies to rub together. Are you still my friend? Yes. Absolutely. It has nothing to do with your money and your details. Good Lord, what kind of a friend is that? That is so shallow and superficial, it's unbelievable. Proverbs 19:4, wealth adds many friends. Win the lottery and they'll come out of the woodwork. They won't really be your friends, not at that level, but there'll be a lot of people vying for your attention. But a poor man is separated from his friend. Also verse 6, many will entreat the favor of a generous man, and every man is a friend to him who gives gifts. Why, that guy, I like you. You're nice. You give me stuff. You must be my friend. I want to be your friend, I can tell you that. You give me things. And also verse 7, all the brothers of a poor man hate him. How much more do his friends go far for him? He pursues them with words, but they are gone. And for some people, when you come into adversity, they don't want to be around for that. They don't want to be around when you're having the difficult times. They just want to tell you, hey, snap out of it. Well, that helps. I feel better. I am infinitely comforted. I've snapped out of it. It was a miracle. All you had to do was tell me. 6, the maximum expression of Category 3 love is physical sacrifice. John 15:13. Where Jesus deals with this issue. And here you have a pretty good idea here because he uses the word agapao, the verb, greater love, and then he uses the word philos for friends. So they're both used here in the same verse. Greater love has no man than this, that one lay down his life for his friends. Physical sacrifice ultimately, and so Jesus demonstrated his friendship certainly to the human race. As he says, I lay down my life, but I have authority to lay it down and to take it back up again. As he died spiritually on the cross for our sins, no greater manifestation of love has ever been seen in the human race. That's the epitome. That is the pinnacle of love. And for that, of course, obviously, he gets great reward. 7, both Category 2 and 3 love, even in regard to immediate family, are not to take precedence over the principles of the truth and cause the believer to compromise his love for God. Deuteronomy 13, 6 and 8. And that is when the principles of doctrine are on the line. Friendship has to go by the wayside at that point. But if you've got really good friends that are doctrinal, I don't find myself with that happening a lot. I don't find myself having to compromise in their presence. And I've had friends talk to me like a Dutch uncle and just spell it out. And just, I mean, we're merciless. I asked somebody a question about one of the doctrines, and his response was, "You've opened up this doctrine with this big steaming pile of crap." What? Well, I didn't have to guess what he meant. It was pretty straightforward. And he said, and he went on and on about it. It wasn't just that he said it. It wasn't that he went on and on about it. I was like, okay, I get the point. Point taken. But you've got to be able to do that. And I'll look at this again. Okay, yeah, he's right. He's right. That point was very obscure and stupid, and I needed to rethink it. So Deuteronomy 13, 6 through 8, if your brother, your mother's son, or your daughter, or your wife you cherish, or your own friend who is as your own soul, entices you secretly, saying, "Let us go and serve other gods, whom neither you nor your fathers have known, or the gods of the peoples who are around you, near you or far from you, from one end of the earth to the other end, you shall not yield to him or listen to him, and your eyes shall not pity him, nor shall you spare or conceal him." And this was if you are counseling rebellion against God in the ranks. This was the death penalty in Israel under the civil code. "You shall surely kill him. Your hand shall be the first to put him to death. Afterward, all the hands of the people." Why? Because the thing here is that the doctrine of separation takes precedence over all these other things. Your love for God has to transcend your love for other people. And in many cases, people are very duplicitous about this. They make claims of their love for God, and then when it's convenient, they socialize with people that are negative. They fail to separate as they're supposed to. And they may separate overtly, but here's the bottom line with separation, and it's in your soul, it's in your heart. People tell me, "Oh, I've separated from them." But in their heart, they haven't. I know it. I'm not fooled. You can tell what people are by just, all you got to do is listen to them and watch them. And they may not overtly, but they haven't broken it off in their soul with these people. Why can't you get on top of this? Because you don't want to. Because the reality is you love them more than you love the Lord at that point, and that's what you have to deal with. Matthew 10, 34 through 37, "Do not think that I came to bring peace on the earth. I did not come to bring peace, but conflict." The sword here would not be physical warfare he's not talking about. He's talking about spiritual conflict. Now, I didn't come, as it were, to draw families together. I came to separate them. I came to separate the sheep from the goats, the positive volition from the negative volition. And that's my job. That's what the truth does. The truth divides. And then, of course, ultimately, if you're positive and you're divided with the truth, you get unified in the truth. Ultimately, "I came to set a man against his father, and a daughter against her mother, and a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law, and a man's enemies will be the members of his household. He who loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. He who loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. And he who does not take his cross and follow after me is not worthy of me." So Jesus spells it out in no uncertain terms that family relationships, well, I got to honor father and mother. That does not negate separation. That's you trying to play one doctrine off against another. That's all that is. This doctrine clearly teaches that separation takes precedence in that situation. And again, we're talking about people who have socialized and maintained relationships with people that are negative, in disobedience to this very verse, in their souls. You've got to deal with it in the soul. That's where it's got to come from. D, here, category 4, love for your enemies. This one's the fun one. Everybody likes their enemies. No, nobody likes their enemies. One, this category has caused a great deal of confusion in Christendom, since many do not understand that this is to be applied on a personal level and not on a corporate or national level. Two, it is entirely inappropriate to apply under this category of love toward criminal types or national enemies who must simply receive justice. Genesis 9, 5, and 6. And here in Genesis 9, we have the institution of what modern man would call capital punishment. Who instituted capital punishment? God did. Man didn't. God did. And it wasn't instituted until after the flood. And God delegated the authority to the government to deal with violations of divine institution number one, which is volition. If God gives a man volition and free will and gives him life and you take it, you forfeit your right to live. It's just that simple. And the problem in our society is we've gotten completely away from that. We think murderers have more rights than their victims. They're certainly going to live longer. They're certainly going to be taken care of on death row, aren't they? And if we do ever execute one of them, it creates such a firestorm that we're supposed to feel bad. I don't feel bad. Yes, I'll pull the trigger. I'll push the button. I'll inject him. I'll help you out. You don't have to feel bad about it. I'll take the guilt. I won't have any, but some people act like this is all wrong. God instituted this, not man. And surely I will require your lifeblood. Verse 5. From every beast I will require it, and from every man, and from every man's brother I will require the life of man. Whoever sheds man's blood, a figure there for murder, by man his blood will be shed. And he cites the whole principle of the image of God and freedom of choice. You've removed this person's freedom of choice. I'm removing yours. And I'm going to use the government to do it. For in the image of God, he made man. Also Deuteronomy 7, 2 and 3. Now this is in warfare. This is another period, another area where people have this inordinate, unfounded, non-biblical guilt. Is it wrong to kill somebody in warfare? No, absolutely not. God doesn't outlaw that. The goal in warfare is to remain a living soldier. That's the chief goal. What's your number one, what's your prime directive? Stay alive. Dead soldiers don't do an army any good. They do the enemy some good, but they don't do that army any good. When the Lord your God shall bring you into the land where you are entering to possess it, and shall clear away many nations before you, the Hittites, the Girgashites, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites, seven nations greater and stronger than you. And when the Lord your God shall deliver them before you, and you shall utterly defeat them, you shall utterly destroy them. You will make no covenant with them, nor you shall show any favor to them. And in warfare, the goal is, as near as I've ever been able to tell, is to kill the enemy. To kill as many of the enemy. That was one of the things I like, you know, Tolkien in that in his trilogy, The Lord of the Rings. It's pretty clear that the goal in warfare is to stay alive and to kill as many of the enemy as you can. And there's not to be any guilt or anything attached to that. That's just the nature of war. So to love your enemies and to take that verse and to try to apply it, well, the Bible says we got to love our enemies so we can't execute capital punishment. That is a complete distortion of what the Bible says. The Bible does not say that. That is the liberal, modern approach to the Scripture. And ironically enough, now go figure, many of the modern liberals who are against capital punishment are for abortion. Isn't this a little inconsistent? I mean, slightly? You know, we're against, you know, killing criminals, but we don't mind killing the innocent. I mean, and obviously this gets into theological questions I'm not going to address here about when somebody becomes alive, which is at the point of physical birth. But still, their position is very inconsistent. And they all base it on, well, the woman has a right to choose. Well, doesn't the victim of a crime have a right to choose? No, he got his rights taken away from him, just as the killer should. That's what the Bible teaches. And capital punishment has not been rescinded. Paul writes about it in Romans 13 as though it is a given fact. The government, he says, does not bear the sword for nothing. And that is the right of capital punishment. And Paul himself would die under capital punishment. But he never said, capital punishment is wrong, we got to outlaw it, let's protest it. He never did any of that. He advocated the position even though ultimately that's how he died. Love for one's enemies was taught in the Mosaic Law and is not a principle that is unique to the New Testament. Exodus 23, 4 and 5. Lest some people try to say, and I've heard this, that, well, you know, it's kind of like God was mean in the Old Testament, and somehow between the Old Testament and the New Testament, God got saved. And he became nice. No, it's the same God. He hasn't changed. He's immutable. And in the Old Testament, this principle is taught, Exodus 23, 4, and 5. If you meet your enemy's ox or donkey wandering away, you shall surely return it to him. If you see the donkey of one who hates you lying helpless under its load, you shall refrain from leaving it to him. You shall surely release it with him. And the idea here is that you do good to your enemies if you're presented with that choice. Now, it doesn't mean you run around looking, well, where's all my enemy's stuff so I can see if I can do good. That's a total... He says, if you see this, if you meet with this, if it happens this way. And so you have the do-gooders. Well, we got to run around and do good to our enemies. No, the Bible doesn't say it. It says, if you have the opportunity, take it. Instead of, what would be the normal human response? That's so-and-so. I hope this ox leaves. I hope somebody kills it or steals it. That's the human viewpoint on the matter. And we've never felt that way, though, right? About our enemies? We've never wished bad on them, have we? If you're normal, you have. Luke 6, 27 and 35. What Jesus is saying here, essentially, is that we have to fight the normal human responses to these things and apply the doctrine to the situation. And what the doctrine says is that if the opportunity is there, you do good. Luke 6, 27. But I say to you who hear, love your enemies. Now, is this a command to feel a particular way? Do I have to have a warm fuzzy? Oh, I see my enemy there. Oh, isn't he sweet? No. First, this is agapao. It's not phileo. And so it focuses on loving as a choice here. You make a choice to love your enemies, to do good to those who hate you, bless those who curse you, and pray for those who mistreat you. Why, that's easy, right? No, this is the challenge to your doctrine. This is the acid test of your relative level of maturity in some ways. Also verse 35, but love your enemies and do good and lend, expecting nothing in return, and your reward will be great, and you will be sons of the Most High. Not that you're not already positionally, you are, but what he's saying is you will demonstrate yourselves to be God's children. For he himself is kind to ungrateful and evil men. For love for one's enemies has nothing to do with how you feel about them emotionally, since one would not normally possess affection for those seeking his harm. My enemy's out to get me. What, I'm sitting around thinking, oh, that's great? No, absolutely not. Five, category four love demands that you focus on what is in the best interest of your enemy and involves the following. A, doing good to them as appropriate opportunities arise, Romans 12, 20. So, and again, you don't have to go searching all this out. God will provide the opportunity if he wants to. I've got this exactly on two sides. On one side of me, I've got this horrible neighbor, and on the other side of me, I've got this really good neighbor. Well, it's easy to like the good neighbor. He's nice to me. You know, I could go over and ask him for anything, and he'd probably do it. Liking the other neighbor isn't so good. So I see his dog out. I put a piece of poison meat out. No, wait a minute, I'm not supposed to do that, right? Call the dog pound. No. You do good. Hey, your dog's out. You go tell them. You inform them. You know, you need help. You know, I said, for those of you who've been by, you've seen this. He's got this 8-foot trench he's dug in his yard, and he just has left it there for months and months now. Really, it makes the neighborhood look nice. And, you know, when I saw him digging it, I went over and said, hey, you know, what's the problem? Are you without water? And he said, no, we got water, but, you know, we got a clog, and this is, you know, it's a drain problem and blah, 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 blah. I said, well, I just wanted to check if you need to hook up a hose here or something, you can do that. Or if you need water, we'll give you some. That's what you're supposed to do. Well, you know, at the time I was doing it, I wasn't necessarily thrilled about it. I wasn't feeling really warm and fuzzy toward him. But I knew what the doctrine said to do, and so I executed. It's easy to execute towards those that love you. Jesus, as a matter of fact, I skipped over, but he alluded to that in that Luke passage. It's easy to love those that love you. It's easy to do good for those that do good for you. The challenge is to do good for those that don't. And so you have to deal with this. Romans 12, 20, but if your enemy is hungry, feed him. And if he is thirsty, give him a drink. For in doing so, you will heap burning coals upon his head. God will deal with him. You have to, at a certain level, you have to step back and say, okay, if you want to make yourself my enemy, that's fine. God will deal with you. I don't have to deal with you. B, you avoid revenge tactics when they personally abuse you, Luke 6:29, and that will probably happen from time to time. You're going to be abused. You're just going to have to deal with it. It happens to everybody. It's a part of life. Luke 6:29, whoever hits you on the cheek, offer him the other one also. And whoever takes away your coat, do not withhold your shirt from him either. And the reality is here, you have to be willing to take the lesser position. You have to be willing to let them do at a certain level what they want to do. Let them go through their whole evil machinations and whatever their plot and their plan is, their hidden agenda, let them run with it. God's going to protect you. And also Romans 12, 17, and 19. Never pay back evil to evil to anyone, or evil for evil, rather, to anyone. Respect what is right in the sight of all men. Never take your own revenge, beloved, but leave room for the wrath of God. Let God dance on their heads. Believe me, he can do a lot more than you can anyway. He can get them at levels that you can't even begin to fantasize about. God knows where they live. He knows really how to put the screws to them if he wants to. You know what ticks us off? That they mistreat us and abuse us and God doesn't do anything. Not that we can see. And so we're like, well, no. God doesn't work fast enough for me. Well, okay, take that up with him the next time you're praying and just let him know. I'm sure he'll appreciate your insight into how the universe should be run. No, I think he knows. See, you avoid mental attitude sins in their direction, Matthew 5, 43 and 44. When you find yourself mentally just tearing them to shreds, and we've all done it. You make yourself, you know, and you work all this out in your mind, and you know, and you've created this whole deal. And in some cases, it's only happening in your mind. But you avoid the mental attitude sins, the revenge tactics, the wanting to get even. When you find yourself going down that path, you say, wait a minute, I got to stop here. Because we all know that the thought is the parent of the deed. You don't do anything you haven't thought about. Matthew 5, 43 and 44, you have heard that it said, you'll love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, in order that you may demonstrate yourself to be sons of your Father who is in heaven. For he causes his sun to rise on the evil and the good and sends rain on the righteous and the unrighteous. And if you love those who love you, what reward is that? What's that big deal? Do not even the tax gatherers do the same? And the idea is, of course they do. If somebody's nice to them, they're nice back. Somebody who's, you know, pleasant to them, they're pleasant back. D, you seek to live in peace with those that are hostile and antagonistic. Romans 12, 18. I guess I could have organized these a little better instead of bouncing back and forth. I could have put them all the Romans ones there together. If possible. So far as it depends on you. And there comes a point where, you know, where peace is not an option. And you've got to be willing to go to war. Okay, if that's the way it's got to be. If we got to go to war over this, fine. We'll go to war. But you really don't want that. As much as you can, you try to just absorb it and move on. But there comes a point where absorbing it and moving on is not the thing to do. So if it is possible, though, so far as it depends on you, be at peace with all men. And guess what? The only reason, you know, at a certain level for the adjusting believer, the only reason you shouldn't be at peace with people is if they've done something to bring this on themselves. I try to live at peace pretty much with everybody. But if things change, you know, and you want to mistreat me and walk all over me, no, at a certain point, I'm not going to stand for that. I don't have to. I'll try to live at peace if possible. But if there comes a point where we got to go to war, fine, we got to go to war. And I don't want that. I frankly don't want that personally. I don't wish that on anybody. And you can see these verses. We've kind of looked at several of these about praying for them. Luke 6, 28, 23, 34, where Jesus demonstrated it. Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. And Acts 7, 60, where Stephen prayed for his enemies as they were stoning him. 6, as you apply towards your enemies, you demonstrate or you imitate God's love as seen in the cross. And you demonstrate your relative level of maturity. And this, again, is very much the acid test. Because this is the toughest one of all. I mean, it's easy to love your friends. Loving your enemies, that's a whole different thing. Matthew 5, and we've just sort of read this. If you greet your brothers only, what do you do more than the others? In verse 47, don't the Gentiles do this? Therefore, you are to be mature. The idea of perfect here has the idea of spiritually complete. As your heavenly Father is complete, is perfect, is mature. He demonstrates his spiritual maturity by the way he treats his enemies. And how does God treat his enemies? Well, he's kind to the just and the unjust alike. 7, therefore, in order to effectively demonstrate this type of love, you must put your natural emotional responses aside and bring the divine viewpoint to bear on the matter. Category 5, love is love for the royal family. 1, this category of love is commanded and is primarily directed toward believers in the local church. All of these letters, of course, are written to local churches. Romans 12. And so first and foremost, again, you have these concentric circles of relationships and of love and of all of that. And, you know, the local church here is kind of where it all begins. That's the smallest one. This is the royal family here. If you can't deal with the 15 or 20 or 30 people, how many ever we have, I don't know. Had to count them all up. And you can't deal with them, how are you ever going to be able to go out there and handle anything else? And God is the one who establishes royal families. He's the one who puts believers where they are. Obviously, he does not do this against our volition. We make choices to be here. All of us did. Every one of us made a choice to be here. And so, in that regard, our volition functions along with the directive will of God. Romans 12:10. Be devoted to one another in brotherly love. Give preference to one another in honor. Also here, 2 Corinthians 2:8. And this is in the context, again, of the incestuous Corinthian and his spiritual recovery. So you may be challenged under this. Somebody really did you wrong. In this case, and you don't get much worse than the incestuous Corinthian, I don't think. And he wants to come back and get his act together. What's going to be your response? As Paul says here, reaffirm your love for him. And he tells them. Because the Corinthians, again, in the first place, when they should have dealt with it, they didn't. And then when he got his act together and wanted to come back, they didn't want to let him back in. No matter which way they did, they were generally, the Corinthians were doing the opposite of what they should have been. That was their nature. And Galatians 5:13 as well. So again, these are commands primarily to be fulfilled first and foremost within the local church. And again, it doesn't mean, as we're going to see, that we don't have responsibilities towards those on the outside. But primarily, your applications have to be here. You say, well, I need to apply towards 8 other people out there. No, you don't. You need to apply towards 8 people here first. People are quick to run off and do things. But this is a kind of the fundy mentality that exists out there. You're more spiritual if you're helping somebody in Africa. Are you really? I don't see that in here. I don't see a bunch of commands to run around the world and do things. We need to send help to missionaries. Why? We're not even supporting the pastor full-time yet. Why would we do that? You haven't taken care of your own ox. Why would you be sending money off to some other guy? That doesn't make any sense to me. Not even, forget the doctrine, even at a fundamental physical level, that doesn't make any sense. So until you fulfilled your first responsibility, until you've taken care of your own children, why would you be worried about anybody else's? And the answer is you shouldn't be. But people have this sort of romantic notion of, I was talking to one believer one time. He said, well, this guy's really a great believer because he's in Africa. Is that where all the great believers live? Well, he applies doctrine in more difficult situations than we do. I don't know. I'm willing to let you walk in my shoes for a month and see. But this is the romantic sort of fundy-eyed notion of, oh, if it's something around the world, halfway around the world, it must be more important. No, absolutely not. What's most important is what's right in front of your face. That's what God's put in front of you. Galatians 5:13, for you were called to freedom, brethren. Only do not turn your freedom into an opportunity to serve the flesh, but through love serve one another. And the whole law is fulfilled in one word. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. But if you bite and devour one another, take care, lest you be consumed by one another. All right, well, our time is up, so we're going to stop there, and we will continue with this on Wednesday. Thank you, Father, for the privilege of studying your word. We pray that you would sanctify this information to our souls. In Christ's name, amen.